Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the study of the early Christian movement and its implications for the church today. As always, we are joined by Michael, our resident ephesiologist. We have Matt Till hanging out in Miami, Florida, and I'm Andrew Johnson, coming to you from Victoria, British Columbia. Today, we have the very exciting privilege to be joined by Mark Thiessen Nation. Now, Mark has had many vocations. He has been a social worker. He's the founding director of a Christian peace and justice organization. He's been a pastor. He's been the director of the London Mennonite Center. If you didn't know, it's in London. And then after 16 years as a professor of theology at Eastern Mennonite Seminary, he is now Professor Emeritus. The joy that we have is to talk with him a little bit about some of his books. The first coming out in 2013 called Bonhoeffer, The Assassin, as well as his 2022 book, Discipleship in a World Full of Nazis. So first of all, great choices of excellent titles, Mark. But before we jump to you and ask you a bazillion and three questions, Matt, I do want to direct it your way. Why can you help, you know, paint the picture why we have Mark with us today?
Well, it's probably more of an intervention for me, maybe. So you had to bring in like the heavy hitters to correct me, apparently. So that's what this is about.
Okay, set the stage. Set the stage. Yeah.
Mark, we're glad that you're here, and we're so excited for this conversation. On a previous podcast, just really a few weeks ago, we were having a discussion, and I brought up Bonhoeffer, and I mentioned Bonhoeffer and just his commitment to what appeared to be pacifism, and yet then I bought into the usual narrative that we have, and that is somehow he became radicalized and was a part of a plot to assassinate Hitler. And I was actually openly questioning that on the podcast. So if our listeners heard that, they'll recall that conversation. And I was openly questioning that. But the emphasis was not on the narrative that he was a part of an assassination plot, but rather his call for nonviolence. And so that's where that conversation kind of ended up and just landed. It was just there in a moment in a broader context. But then offline, we had this conversation, Andrew and Michael and myself, they directed about you and your book and your writings. And I've been actually digging through the discipleship book and just been floored by your research. So, Mark, it's a pleasure to have you. Talk to us. Why am I wrong?
We don't have enough time on this podcast. Matt?
I assume you mean, why are you wrong in relation to Bonhoeffer and not all the other ways?
Oh, yeah.
Mark's a friend. I appreciate this now.
if you can help us in correcting his other failings, that would be great as well.
While we have you here.
Yeah. Well, I won't claim to be any kind of expert on Matt Till. How much time do you have? So to give the brief version, yeah, there's been this standard account of Bonhoeffer's life that's been available since the 1960s. One of his two closest friends as an adult was Eberhard Bethge, who wrote the definitive biography, which is about 1,000 pages long. And it's the one that began this understanding of Bonhoeffer, who he claimed, Bethge claimed, that Bonhoeffer was never a pacifist. But on the other hand, he does give the evidence within his biography that would seem to say that Bonhoeffer was a pacifist. So then he also says, that is Eberhard Bethge, that inasmuch as he was a pacifist or close to it, he changed by 1939 or 1940. Because he became involved with the conspirators, the conspiracy within Nazi Germany of those who were attempting to kill Hitler. And Bonhoeffer was affirming of the attempts to kill Hitler and perhaps was somewhat involved in various ways. So that's kind of the standard story. I went to a fascinating conference in 1984 in Seattle, Washington. So there was a confessional meeting called the Barman that produced something called the Barman Confession in May of 1934. And in 1984, there were commemorative events. I assume there was one, at least one in Germany, and there was one in the U.S. in Seattle, Washington. So a number of Germans came, including Eberhard Bethge and his wife, including another of Bonhoeffer's students at his seminary, spoke at this meeting. And his other best friend, Franz Hildebrandt, also spoke at this gathering in Seattle, Washington in 1984. Franz Hildebrandt, unlike Bethge, was a lifelong pacifist. And when he first heard that Bonhoeffer was involved in attempts to kill Hitler, he didn't believe it because he knew Bonhoeffer, and he resonated even while he was while they were still together in the mid and late 1930s. He agreed with Bonhoeffer in his pacifism. And so he resonated with that pacifism till the day he died. In 1984, he said, if Franz Hildebrandt said in his lecture, that if there is one book every pastor should read, it's The Politics of Jesus by John Howard Yoder. He said that because he thought it was an important book. It talked about the social realities of the church and talked about and made an argument for pacifism. Anyway, I have wanted to counter this dominant narrative, which is really replicated now in every biography there is in print, so far as I know.
And film.
And film,
yeah. Yes. Right? Yeah.
Yes. The film that came out last year, in November, I think it came out. I don't know whether it came out earlier in some places than November, but October and November, the new film that came out last year, is, I think, I don't know whether the three of you have seen it, but I think as a film, I'm not a film critic, so I'm not one who's really qualified to make the following comment, but I thought as a film, it was very well done. I've heard six interviews with the director. Mm-hmm. He certainly worked hard to make this a quality film. All of the main actors were Germans. The man who played Bonhoeffer is a German, though they spoke English because he knew if it had subtitles, it wouldn't be as popular. So they spoke English, but they were German. I thought they did a very good job of acting. I thought the script in many ways was quite good, but it gives a very deceptive, probably the most deceptive portrait of Bonhoeffer that's been given, period, because it really mostly ignores Bonhoeffer's theology. And in fact, says that Bonhoeffer came to hate theology by the early 30s, which simply is not true. There's very little theology, and there's some scenes that are just, like I said, deceptive. I don't think they're intentionally deceptive. I don't know much about the director other than the interviews I've heard. But having said both of those things, it's a quality film. There's much that's deceptive in the film. In some ways, the main message that I think he wanted to convey is fairly standard in most of the biographical accounts. And that is that pacifists are irresponsible. And so if you're going to deal with evil such as Nazism, you have to be willing to do horrible things. You have to be willing, for instance, to kill your president, your leader, your Führer, who's still very popular with all Germans. I mean, he has a man trying to assassinate Hitler in 1939, summer of 1939. One of the problems with the film is the chronology is kind of messed up. So I don't know that he intended to convey this, but he's having this assassin trying to kill Hitler in the summer of 1939. If you know the chronology of World War II, World War II has not begun. Hitler is popular with the German people. Really, in the year 2024 in the United States, you want to be suggesting that Americans should try to assassinate people they believe to be evil when those things were actually happening in 2024? I don't really think that's what he wanted to suggest, but I do think he wanted to suggest, which is obvious throughout the film, that to be responsible, you have to get your hands dirty, as is said once in the film. But really what you have to be willing to do is take dramatic actions such as trying to assassinate those who are at the root of the evil that's happening.
This film review is brought to you by Mark. Also, the subtitle is Mrs. Lincoln. Aside from that, how was the play?
So I think that was pretty strongly, we can understand the thrust. I part of my interest, and through your research, Mark, why would you say this idea about Bonhoeffer being the assassin, aside from the tome written by his friend, why did that become the popular take? Why did it take so long for somebody to look back at historical records and interviews with people who were there, other writings of Bonhoeffer? Why did the idea of him as the assassin take such hold?
Good question. I mean, obviously, when I say something in response to that sort of question, I have to be speculative because we don't really know. What I tend to think is that most theologians, most pastors don't really resonate with pacifism. And in fact, they have stereotypes of pacifism and really have not investigated pacifism seriously, either in terms of practice or in thinking about various theologies related to pacifism. And there is a variety of theologies and philosophies that give rise to what could
can
be
you,
called.
Like, yeah. Very quickly define pacifism, just so that we're having a conversation around common terms.
Yes. So I tend to continue to use the term pacifist or pacifism. I'm a Mennonite. A lot of Mennonites don't like the term anymore. A lot of people who have considered themselves pacifist don't like to use the label anymore because they know that so many people believe that pacifism is spelled with two S's and a V, but it's not. It's P-A-C-I-F-I-S-M. It's often understood as a refusal to participate violently in wars. I mean, that's the bottom line for many people. And what Bonhoeffer gave more of his attention to than any single public issue during his short lifetime was whether to participate in war. I have a chapter in my book, Discipleship in a World Full of Nazis, where I deal with Bonhoeffer's peace lectures. In all of his peace lectures, he says that Christians should not participate in war. So that's what pacifism is often associated with. But I've been a pacifist since 1971. I became a conscientious objector during Vietnam War. I'm barely old enough to have been eligible for the Vietnam War. I grew up in a non-Christian home, became a Christian in the fall of 1970. And within a year, I had to register for the draft. And the Baptists, among whom I became a Christian, told me I should read my New Testament and my Bible. So I did. My Lord said I should love my enemies. I didn't know how that equaled killing them. So I became a conscientious objector in the fall of 1971, not because of the Vietnam War particularly. I would study wars more seriously later, but because my Lord said I should love my enemies. That's really the same conclusion Bonhoeffer came to, apparently, while he was in New York City in 1930-31. So it was for him initially mostly connected to war. But he also wrote a letter to Mahatma Gandhi and received a response from Gandhi, inviting him to study with Gandhi, which he really wanted to do. And that was not about war. That was about resisting Hitler in a nonviolent way. So he was interested in doing that. So it's usually also, so pacifism is a word that is about not being committed to nonviolence, usually in all segments of life, including when one's nation decides to go to war. So it's about being committed to nonviolence. And one of the reasons why I continue to use the word pacifism and not just the word nonviolence is once one makes nonviolence a practical strategy, one can be too preoccupied with accomplishing certain goals. And therefore, if you can't accomplish those certain goals, you give up on being committed to nonviolence. Pacifism lays the offensiveness of the cross and of our commitment to love our enemies right on the table. That is, pacifism means that we're willing to die rather than kill. It doesn't mean, however, that we have to be passive in the face of evil. Bonhoeffer was not passive. One of the things I've done in several of the reviews, in several of the interviews I've done about the film is saying that Bonhoeffer was basically irresponsible until he got involved in the attempts to kill Hitler, the plots that were underway. there's nothing that's true about that in Bonhoeffer's story. I mean, war was a very live issue in all of Bonhoeffer's adult life and really in his childhood.
Sure.
Because he was a child when World War I happened. It is his brother's death is depicted very briefly. One of his two brothers who were in World War I died on the battlefield. That his funeral is depicted in the film from last year. What is not depicted is the fact that his mother was basically decimated by her son's death. She could not function as a mother for many months. His oldest sister had to really take their mother's place for many months because his mother was absolutely decimated by her son's death. Bonhoeffer was well aware of the pain and suffering related to World War I. So when he started giving lectures in 1930, where he started speaking against war, he knew what he was talking about. And then World War II happened, and Hitler reintroduced the military draft, which was in 1935, it was about the same time that Bonhoeffer started directing his seminary. And Hitler came on the radio talking about the fact that he was introducing the military draft, which had been prohibited after World War I because of Germany's aggressiveness in World War I. But it was reintroduced in 1935. Hitler came on the radio. All of Bonhoeffer's students, and these are students who are in an illegal seminary, who are part of the confessing church, to a person, the way Betke reports it, the students were excited about this because
wow.
Many thought because they were part of the confessing church that they were not patriots. They were not German patriots. They wanted to be perceived as German patriots. But Betke, who, as I said, I don't think totally resonated with Bonhoeffer's pacifism, Betke notices that the director of the seminary doesn't feel the same way, and he certainly didn't. He started then to encourage all of his students to be conscientious objectors and not to go into the military. And that's what Bonhoeffer himself had been advocating at various ecumenical gatherings when he would give these peace lectures. And he himself worked diligently to avoid being in the military, killing on the front lines. And he managed to avoid it, but he could do so partly because he was privileged. I mean, Bonhoeffer came from an upper, very upper middle class family. His father was a psychiatrist, and so he made a lot of money, and so they had significant money. They had aristocratic heritages on both sides of Bonhoeffer's family. They were quite comfortable. Bonhoeffer was aware of that. Part of what that meant, especially because they had aristocratic heritage on both sides, he was connected to a lot of people in high places. So in the spring of 1940, when he was no longer allowed to teach students in a seminary, he apparently had conversations with his brother-in-law, Hans von Danani, who worked for the Abwehr, which was a military intelligence organization. And his brother-in-law and his brother-in-law's boss said to Bonhoeffer, apparently, this is what a German theologian and I both concluded, that if you come to work for the Abwehr, this military intelligence agency in 1940, and by 1940, the military has been trying to conscript him for more than a year into military service. They say, if you come to work for the Abwehr, we can say to the proper officials that your work for the Abwehr is absolutely essential for the welfare of Germany. If we can make that argument and they believe it, then you will be exempt from military service on the front lines. He will not have to kill in the name of Hitler, which is what everybody was doing at that time.
Hmm. Now, well, Mark, some are going to object with you, and you know this, and I appreciate so much how you introduced this in your recent book, Discipleship. But some will object that, aren't you reading your Anabaptist Mennonite background into Bonhoeffer and therefore making him to be what Metaxas does on the other side? Created in his image rather than truly understanding Bonhoeffer.
Yes. two things. One quick comment about Eric Metaxas and his biography of Bonhoeffer. Eric Metaxas, just like this director, did a good job directing the film as a film. So Eric Metaxas is a great writer. And I don't think his biography is as bad as some Bonhoeffer scholars say it is. But he buys into the standard line and it serves his purposes. But one of the things he does, and it's unique. One of the things he does in his biography is he is deceptive, I document this in my book in a footnote and how he is, because he quotes from this letter that Bonhoeffer wrote to his longtime friend, Elizabeth Zinn. Bonhoeffer wrote this letter to her in January of 1936, talking about the five ways that his life changed while he was in New York City in 1930-31. He basically underwent a conversion. And one of the things he names is he said, "I came to see pacifism as self-evident." Metaxas quotes from that letter twice. One of the times he just partially quotes from it. But the other time he's quoting from the whole letter with one exception. He leaves out that line. He leaves out the line where Bonhoeffer said, "I came to see pacifism as self-evident." And then he proceeds to say, Bonhoeffer was never a pacifist. He disagreed with his pacifist friend at Union Theological Seminary in 1930-31, which is certainly not true. And he never taught conscientious objection to his students, which even Betke acknowledges. Betke and one other student, at least, have acknowledged in print that Bonhoeffer advocated conscientious objection for his students. But Metaxas denies all of that, having left out this quote, among other things he leaves out.
Interesting.
But
like you say, to serve his purpose.
Yes.
So, in painting Bonhoeffer.
But to talk about my own story and whether or not, yes, I've been accused of this. So I have my first appendix in the book is responding to this accusation. So for 30 years, I wrote my master's thesis on Christians in Nazi Germany in 1980. And in the same semester, I wrote a 72-page essay on the Confessing Church. So I had already done considerable research related to Bonhoeffer in 1980. Hmm. 9 years later, I wrote an essay on Bonhoeffer and pacifism under a visiting Czech Bonhoeffer scholar. That is a Bonhoeffer scholar from the Republic of Czechoslovakia. Or what did it change its name to? It's no longer called
1993. It actually became the Czech Republic and then Slovakia.
So I guess it was still Czechoslovakia.
Yep, still is there.
Okay.
Bonus points for Andrew for knowing that off the top of his head, by the way.
So this visiting scholar taught me this directed course on Bonhoeffer, which he was an expert in. And I wrote my essay on Bonhoeffer and pacifism. A brief version of the essay was published in 1991. So I started doing research in 1989. I did another round of research under Ray Anderson at Fuller Seminary, also writing on Bonhoeffer and pacifism. For 30 years, from 1980s, sometime in the 1980s till 2010, I was convinced by Eberhard Betke that Bonhoeffer, if he was ever a pacifist, switched. What I said in my 1989 essay, which was 47 pages long, I said that he was probably never a pacifist, but he was closer to pacifism than any other options. I was saying that because who was I to challenge the authority of Eberhard Betke? That's what I said.
Right.
1989, which was quite appropriate. I didn't know enough to challenge Eberhard Betke's authority. But after doing two or three more rounds of research, and especially during my sabbatical from teaching here in Eastern Mennonite Seminary, I read most of Bonhoeffer's collected writings. There's 16 volumes of them. And I read a lot of secondary writings on Bonhoeffer. And after 30 years of agreeing with Betke, I just had to depart from his narrative because it just isn't true. When you look at the sources carefully, it doesn't substantiate what Betke's claims are. So it's not only that I'm not trying to make Bonhoeffer into an Anabaptist or a Mennonite, I had my mind changed by going more deeply into the sources and just coming to the conclusion that I could no longer just go along with a narrative that was just simply wrong. I mean, there are a few details that we simply can't know, And I try to be honest about those. But what we do know is that Bonhoeffer continued to argue for nonviolence really until the end of his writing life in 1944.
Mark, what I really appreciate about this conversation and what you've put in the book in Discipleship in a World Full of Nazis is you actually have this line in there that I thought was very interesting, and you back it up. And that is how Betke was not so much wasn't falsifying, but rather seemed to be vague in the biography. And yes. Because he was vague, as a result, perhaps misleading. And so you kind of pull in that context there. And as you've been discussing here on this podcast, and again, backed up in the book, and I also, what I felt to be really compelling is the context. You go to great lengths to discuss and talk about the social context that Bonhoeffer was living. And you talk about the rise of nationalism in Germany in post-World War I. And how that was not only shaping in Bonhoeffer's life for him personally, and again, you've got a lot of research to back this up, but also what was happening in the context of the Protestant church and how there was this great alignment with Nazi ideology and nationalism and he was working actively, which we have plenty of writings on, to work against and to persuade away from being like, we're not going to go down this road of Nazi ideology, but also continuing to press into really a greater call for discipleship that still involves this work of what appears to be, you know, pacifism or nonviolence. And really what we read about in The Cost of Discipleship, and that is love your enemy and this radical call. Speak more about that and that context in which he was, the elements that were kind of stewing in that time period in which he was writing, and how it's quite possible that his writings were either misunderstood and perhaps some of the dynamics that maybe he was trying to work around, having family members that were well known in government as well.
Yes. Yes. Sorry, I have to take a breath because I always try to discern in this sort of interview. I mean, I'd probably go on already with too many details that people get lost in. It's a complicated situation, a complicated set of context. Because on the one hand, there are the varied German context. One of the things he writes a letter to his grandmother. Let me back up. In mid 1933. Martin Niemöller, who was well known as a U-boat captain from World War I, and he was one of the main leaders in what became the Confessing Church movement. He was becoming friends, he's portrayed in the film, he was becoming friends with Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer, of course, was quite young at this point. Nobody knew who Bonhoeffer was. So Bonhoeffer was a nobody, but Martin Niemöller was not a nobody. But Niemöller could see the brilliance in this young Bonhoeffer. And so he asked Bonhoeffer and I think one other person to compose a confession for the Confessing Church, which Bonhoeffer did with at least one other person in August of 1933. While he was writing this confession, he sent a letter to his grandmother, and he said to her that the alternatives for us really are Germanism or Christianity. And I love the term Germanism rather than nationalism. Certainly in our context, nationalism and even Christian nationalism is a loaded term, mostly simply used against one particular political orientation. But I would argue that Americanism is sort of the default setting for many Christians in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Preach. Wait, on either side. It doesn't matter if you're right or left.
Preach.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. I think it's true. I don't know if you want me to name specifics about today's political contentions.
Well, probably, I mean, I think our listeners will probably be able to make the connections themselves. But
yes,
but
we have smart listeners.
We do, but at the same time, like, and also in a, we don't want to alienate either. But I do think that the complexity, and maybe you can more talk to almost kind of put us in the shoes and the mind of Bonhoeffer and recognizing what were the pressures that maybe he might have been feeling like he was facing in this time. Because I think it just kind of puts into some context of those who are pastors today who like there are things that I disagree with in this world. I'm not really sure how to speak out against that or who I should be siding with when my congregation might be moving in one direction and I feel like my conscience before God is moving me in another. I think Bonhoeffer kind of serves as an interesting person in the past. And then again, but did he really align himself with a, you know, some sort of assassination attempt? I think, and you're breaking that down for us. So I think he serves as a very interesting person. Maybe you could just talk briefly about what were the pressures that he was facing and that social society and what was happening in culture in that very moment, in those moments for him.
Yeah. Well, very much contra the film from late last year, Bonhoeffer was a theologian from beginning to end. So one of the things, again, that's difficult is there is the German context and there is the nationalism, there is the Germanism, and that's important. But his family of origin was basically an unchurched family. He didn't grow up in church. He was baptized, and I believe he went through catechesis. But when he was 13 years old, he became a Boy Scout and attended Boy Scout meetings on Sunday mornings. And as Betke says, he didn't seem aware that many families went to church on Sunday mornings. But most of his family members, all of them, so far as I know, were against Hitler. Well, why were they against Hitler? They weren't for the theological reasons, the Christian reasons that Bonhoeffer was, at least not prominently. So again, there is the German context, and of course there are varied strands of German ways of thinking about these things. There's not just one kind of German. But there are also the theological issues, and the theological issues are really what Bonhoeffer is mostly, certainly consciously, reflecting on and wrestling with. For instance, he had been at Union Theological Seminary in 1930-31. Bonhoeffer was always someone who took away stuff from wherever he was. So as much as he might differ with some of his professors at Berlin University or at Union Theological Seminary or at Tübingen, those are the three places he studied, he always took away from those places a lot, positively, as well as being critical of much of what he was being taught. I say that because when he was at Union Seminary, most of the professors were pacifists, so I have read, because a lot of theologians reacted to the horribleness of World War I. And I don't imagine it was just theologians who did that. So it was a reaction to World War I. Reinhold Niebuhr was one of his teachers at Union Theological Seminary. And Niebuhr's realism, of course, is what influences a lot of people to want Bonhoeffer not to be a pacifist by the end. If he ever was, then he became a realist. But Bonhoeffer specifically, in a number of his writings, alludes to Niebuhr's writings quite negatively. He didn't like his social ethics because they were not really very theological and certainly not Christological in the way that Bonhoeffer was. Not Christ-centered. Mm-hmm. Christ as someone who calls us to love our enemies in embodied ways was not what Niebuhr was about, certainly not after he rejected pacifism in the 1930s, that is Niebuhr. So there's that on the one hand, but also there's kind of a social progressivism that's dominant at Union Theological Seminary. It's called the social gospel was very dominant at Union Seminary, at least with some of the professors. And again, Bonhoeffer, after he was at Union, never imagined that you could live as a Christian without caring about public social issues, but not in the way that he learned the social gospel at Union Seminary. His way of approaching it was different. It was more in line with Karl Barth. So he was deeply influenced by Karl Barth's theology beginning in the winter of 1924-25 was when he first read Barth. When he first read Barth, he was energized by what he read. He had his own kind of conversion that I think began with Barth, just as Barth had sort of a conversion through reading Romans and being a pastor in the midst of World War I, when he saw most of his German theological professors endorsing Germany's war during World War I. And Barth was just horrified by this kind of nationalism and militarism. And Barth, from that point forward, was always anti-nationalist and came close to being a pacifist. He said any Christian who knows their New Testament will be a pacifist in practice. That's what Barth said in Church Dogmatic.
Wow.
John Howard Yoder wrote a book called Karl Barth and the Problem of War. There's a version of it that I edited that's still in print. And he shows how the logic of Barth's theology should have made him a pacifist. And then for a variety of reasons, Barth made an argument to give himself an out. But he mostly was, he certainly tilted strongly toward pacifism.
This is so good, Mark. Yeah, this is so good, setting that context. I came across your book, Bonhoeffer, the Assassin, with a question mark on it, and intrigued by the title because, as you shared, I was deeply influenced by the traditional view of who Barth was. But after reading him, to ethics and discipleship, you just can't get there if you really are paying attention to his life and the trajectory of it from the time he left Germany to go to study in New York. It just seemed like he was on that trajectory to embrace pacifism, and there was no turning back from that. But when we think about the traditional picture of him plotting against Hitler, what are the points of evidence that we have that tell us otherwise? Why is it that he is not associated with those assassination attempts? I mean, the pacifism is one thing, right? But there's actual evidence that it seems to me, if I remember your first book correctly, that there's actual evidence that's not indicating that there was any connection with Bonhoeffer in those attempts.
Yeah. Well, yes, the first chapter of my Discipleship in a World Full of Nazis is on Eberhard Bethge's biography and why I think it has convinced a lot of people that he was involved. And as was said by Matt earlier, part of what I say is that Bethge is vague, but he seems to imply that Bonhoeffer was involved in various ways. So let me recount the two main, quote, pieces of evidence. One, I think it was when I was working on the first book that I would just kind of informally ask a lot of people at the Society of Christian Ethics meeting and the American Academy of Religion meeting, which I used to go to every year, both of those professional organizations. I would just ask people that I knew, major ethicists in the United States and from other countries for that matter. I would ask them what they believe about Bonhoeffer in this regard. Many of them thought he was arrested on April 5th, 1943, because he was involved in one of the two attempts on Hitler's life in March of 1943. I understand why they believe that. For one thing, again, Bethge's account in his biography is vague. But I've read, I don't know, I have about 7 books on the assassination attempts. I lined up Bonhoeffer's biography with the attempts on Hitler's life. So there were two attempts in March of 1943. One was an attempt where a bomb was placed on Hitler's plane, and it was to go off before he landed at his retreat center where he would go to from Berlin. And it would have gone off, but something happened. And the theory is, for the reason it didn't detonate, is that the heat wasn't working properly on the plane, so it was very cold. And they believe that the fuse didn't work properly because it was so cold in the plane. Whatever the reason was, that bomb didn't explode. But it's also the case that nobody except the person who planted the bomb knew about that bomb being planted on the plane, because it wasn't discovered by any authorities. That's the one attempt. The second attempt.
How do we know about that single bomb being placed on there? Was it just afterwards them talking about the fact that, yes, I was the one who planted the bomb there and now it's known?
Yes. Well, I said only one person. I mean, there might have been two or three people who knew, but the authorities who would have done the arresting didn't know. Never. It was never discovered by the people who mattered that would have arrested people. Yeah, there might have been two or three people involved in the plotting, but there were only a couple or three people. Certainly not Bonhoeffer and not his brother-in-law, I don't believe, in that particular instance. So, after the war was over, then various people who were involved in these attempts have given accounts of what happened. So, yes, we know the people involved, who was involved, and the details. That's how these books are written.
Yeah.
Done research. Of course, most of this wasn't written down. You had to interview people who were involved. The other attempt in March of 43 was the one that's portrayed in the film, except it didn't happen in the summer of 39. It happened in March of 1943. This is where this is the first suicide bombing I have ever known about. So there's a man who was given the task of escorting Hitler through the viewing of weapons that were captured by Germans from Russians. And so they were put on display to show that Germany was being successful in the war. Hitler, every year that the war was going, that Russia was involved in the war, Hitler would go through this exhibit every year. And usually he would take at least a half hour, sometimes an hour and a half, to go through this exhibit. But by 1943, Hitler was very nervous about people trying to kill him. So he only stayed at that exhibit for about a minute and a half or 2 minutes. The bombs, the man had, I believe, two bombs in his pockets who was going to kill Hitler. He was escorting him through the exhibit. He had the bomb set to go off in 9 minutes, thinking that Hitler would be there at least 30 minutes. So he was there for a minute and a half. The guy has to go into the bathrooms and defuse the bombs so that they wouldn't go off. So that never happened. But again, nobody knew about this, except a couple or three people, and they had nothing to do with Bonhoeffer. It could be that his brother-in-law, Hans von Danani, had something to do with one or both of these, because bombs were difficult to secure. Hans von Danani, Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law, had access to bombs. He was very high up in the Abwehr. So he may have helped secure one or both of these bombs. But there's no evidence at all that Bonhoeffer was involved in either of these. Why was he arrested on April 5th, 1943? Bonhoeffer and his brother-in-law, Hans von Danani, were involved in something called, what was it called? Now I just lost the name. Was given the number 7. I can't think of the word connected with 7. But anyway, it was an effort to save the lives originally of 7 Jews, and it became 14 Jews. So they helped 14 Jews to relocate, to leave Germany and to relocate in Switzerland. And in doing that, they gave them, I think, hundreds of thousands of marks so that they would have enough money to relocate in Switzerland. The officials, by 1943, were skeptical of what was going on, quite appropriately, in the Abwehr. They knew that some of the head leaders in the Abwehr were not very thrilled with the Hitler government. So they were surveilling them regularly, and they found out that there were irregularities in the books. And the irregularity related to the money that was given to these Jews to resettle in Switzerland. So they were furious on two accounts. One was that they didn't like people who were not anti-Semitic like they were. So they didn't like some of the people working for the Abwehr to be helping Jews. And secondly, they assumed incorrectly that the men involved in this effort, successful effort to get these Jews relocated in Switzerland, were pocketing some of this money. So because of that, the ones that they knew were involved, Bonhoeffer and his brother-in-law, Hans von Danani, were two of them. They were arrested on April 5th, 1943. Mm-hmm. That's why he was arrested. We now have an account of Bonhoeffer's trial that I think I read they found in Russia, which is in the 16th volume of the Collected Works. And the account of Bonhoeffer's trial tells us what the judge was so ticked off about in Bonhoeffer's case. Nothing is mentioned about his involvement in attempts to kill Hitler. What the judge mentions is that Bonhoeffer was deliberately attempting to avoid military service. And the judge did not like that. And he said that very clearly. So that's why Bonhoeffer was then imprisoned. And then in 1945, he was executed because thousands of people were executed after the attempt on Hitler's life in July of 1944.
So,
Mark, is trying to kill Hitler.
Yeah. So is this the context in which we should be reading his ethics?
No, not real. No. I mean, yes. Those who want to believe that he shifted his views from, again, most who know Bonhoeffer's writings well and are honest know that he sounded like a pacifist in the mid-30s. I mean, how can you deny that the book Discipleship, or The Cost of Discipleship, as it used to be called, it has arguments for nonviolence, strong arguments. So it's hard to deny that. But so those who are honest and know Bonhoeffer's writings will admit that he sounded like a pacifist in the mid-30s. So if you believe that he shifted around 1939, 1940, then yes, the ethics, the manuscripts that Bonhoeffer wrote, which he never finished, they were unfinished manuscripts that then were published after he died into a book that is called Ethics. They look for evidence in ethics for him to justify his shift from the mid-30s to the late-30s, the beginning of the 40s. There is no such evidence, as I show in my chapter in Discipleship in a World Full of Nazis. I have one chapter on ethics. I go through the first four chapters. The fourth chapter is the one that has so much language that to many sounds like it's justifying something, some kind of violence, possibly. So I go through the first three chapters to show the whole setup makes it clear that that's not what he's doing at all. In fact, he still has the same views that were articulated in the book Discipleship. Yeah. He is wrestling with some issues in some complicated ways in the fourth chapter.
Yeah, and you do this beautifully in both of your books. You lay this out. So I wasn't very clear in my question. His arrest was due to really exploiting German funds in order to pay for the Jews leaving the country. And so when you said that, it triggered in my mind in his ethics how he at least seems to allude to the idea that, you know, there are times when you might have to do something that seems contradictory to law or to your faith or something that that can be justified properly because of the result. And it made me wonder if that might be the context in which Bonhoeffer is writing, that here he is, you know, in essence stealing from the German government. It is the Third Reich, right? From the German government. And he's using it for good purposes, you know, a wrong act used for good purposes and so on. But anyway, so I mean, it just was interesting that that possible connection. Am I understanding that correctly or misguided by Eric Metaxas again? Or
no, I mean, there's some, I mean, one of the things, if I were younger, I wish I were younger to write more on Bonhoeffer. I would love to do a serious academic biography of Bonhoeffer that would deal with a lot of things that I haven't dealt with yet in my two books. And one of the things I'd like to deal with, I deal with this a little bit in a couple of chapters, but not as much as I would like to have. Bonhoeffer was so honest and so willing to reflect on the challenges in living in Nazi Germany. I mean, for instance, he has an essay on lying. I'm working with a woman who's writing a doctoral thesis in one of her chapters. Her whole doctoral thesis is on truth and truthfulness, and she's doing a chapter on Bonhoeffer. So we're looking at his writings on truth and truthfulness and lying. He wrote an essay specifically on truth and lying, and he knew that it was difficult to live with integrity in Nazi Germany. When you're not allowed to listen to the BBC, you can be arrested and lose your life for listening to the BBC radio station because it's anti-Nazi. You could be arrested for any number of reasons. I remember reading a book when I first did my research in 1980 that you could be arrested for complaining about having to eat margarine rather than butter. And you could be arrested for complaining that your children were in the Hitler Youth or try to keep your children from being in the Hitler Youth. It was so dangerous to live in Nazi Germany. And Bonhoeffer, in his essay called 10 Years After, which is in the at the beginning of the book, Letters and Papers from Prison, it's an extraordinary set of reflections on how difficult Bonhoeffer thought it was to come back to living a truthful life after Nazism. Mm-hmm. He was pissed about that, and you're naming one element of that. Yes, they used funds from the Abwehr to help German Jews escape to Switzerland. Well, isn't that being honest?
The tension, I think, speaks so much to like the life of Bonhoeffer. You can read about it in Discipleship. You can read about it in your book. And you can see it so clearly that there's this call to a higher moral standard. And yet still the everyday life that is in front of you, it lives in such great tension that one demands such a cruciformed approach to one's beliefs and theology and ethic that confronts the individual. Martin Luther King dealt with this. We see this in Bonhoeffer in this time. And it does seem like Bonhoeffer, no matter what, was arrested as we should call just an enemy of the state. But so were thousands of others and executed for similar crimes, whether they were true crimes or not, or chalked up. He spoke out against the evils of the day that were taking place. And I mean, I think that's the life that's the message we always want to hear from Bonhoeffer. That's the one that we love. That's the one that we appreciate as those who want to live faithfully and say he spoke out against the evil. And he was standing for what was good. And then the question is, what do you do about it? What does action look like afterwards? It seems to be the debate. And yet, I've just so appreciated your book and this conversation, Mark.
Yes. Yeah. Well, go ahead, Andrew.
No, Mark, please, after you.
Well, I wanted to say a couple more things that I didn't say in response to Matt's earlier question. I think it was Matt who asked it about context. Again, one of the things is difficult dealing with Bonhoeffer and complicated in a variety of ways, but I'll try to say this fairly briefly, is that on the one hand, contrary again to many accounts, as someone committed to nonviolence by 1931 or 32, Bonhoeffer was being very responsible in a public way. So he was giving these peace lectures. But even giving the peace lectures, it was complicated for him because he was trying to figure out how he could call Christians to nonviolence without doing that in a way that he thought was theologically wrong. So most of those were pacifists in the early 1930s in the ecumenical gatherings to which he would speak, had a kind of liberal theology that he didn't agree with. So he was trying to convey into that world a kind of Barthian and Kierkegaardian way of thinking about these things, but was still committed to nonviolence. So he was trying to work this out even as he spoke publicly at these various gatherings. So he was doing that in 1932 through 1930. Well, mostly in 1932 was when he gave these peace lectures. He gave another one in the fall of 1934. And then in 1933, he's again trying to do this in other ways or other contexts. So Hitler assumes power at the end of January in 1933. By April of 1933, so very early in Hitler's regime, and Hitler's not Führer yet, he's only Chancellor, but he's granted quite a bit of power by the man who is the head of German government. Already by April of 1934, Bonhoeffer writes an essay in which he describes four different ways in which Christians should respond to the anti-Semitism that is beginning to be enshrined in laws that will first marginalize and then lead to the execution of many Jews. Of course, he doesn't know where all this is going to lead, but he's always just so insightful about what's unfolding. So he writes this very early essay. He gives it as a lecture, I think, twice. I think it's published in two different journals. And then he gets involved in the church debates that start to unfold. And so he's involved in many different church meetings in 1933, mm-hmm. where he's trying to prevent the Protestant church. He's not connected much to the Catholic Church. He's a Protestant, meaning he's probably Lutheran. He has elements of his thought that are Lutheran and Reformed, probably, but he's basically a Lutheran. And there are churches that are united, both Reformed and Lutheran, some that are Lutheran, some that are Reformed. They have these gatherings, and Hitler is trying to co-opt the church and trying to co-opt the church so they will be totally in line with Nazism. And Bonhoeffer works tirelessly trying to keep that from happening. And then, as I said earlier, one of the last things he does in that regard directly is formulating this confession in August of 1933, which ends up not becoming the official confession for the Confessing Church. And then he has to leave, just like he left to go to America in 1930-31. So he leaves to go to England between 1933 and 1935 to pastor two small German-speaking congregations in London. And he goes there, it seems, because he has to reflect critically on whether or not he's simply being arrogant. Why is he the only one who sees these things? Why does he disagree with so many of his friends? Franz Hildebrandt is one of the few close friends he has with whom he's almost totally in sync with about key issues. And he also is in pretty much in alignment with Karl Barth. But by 1930, yeah, and in 33 to 35, Barth's still in Germany. Barth, though he's Swiss, was teaching in Germany. And Barth, in fact, is upset that Bonhoeffer's in London because he says, you need to go back immediately to Germany. They need you. Bonhoeffer knows that he needs to do a lot of self-critical reflection so that he knows whether he's actually being faithful or just arrogant. And he becomes convinced that he's right. And so then when he's asked, he goes back to Germany in the spring of 1935 to direct one of the five confessing church seminaries. And he does that for 5 years, longer than he does any other single task. He does it for 2 years at Finkenwalde in one location. That is closed by the Gestapo in September of 1937. And soon after that, he starts training seminarians in various locations until the spring of 1940, when the Gestapo closes the seminary for good. And that's when he talks to his brother-in-law and his brother-in-law's boss, and then becomes an agent, a civilian agent for the Abwehr, so that he can avoid military service. Yeah. And then in between all of that, while he's still technically the director of the seminary, he goes to New York City in 1939 to escape military service mostly, but also because his friends are concerned that he's going to get killed. So he goes to New York City, and then he decides on the ship over, really. But certainly within the next couple of weeks, he discerns that it is really unfaithful. It is a cowardly way out to go to New York City and to be in the U.S. He needs to go back to Germany to suffer with his brothers and sisters in Christ. And so he does that only a few weeks after he arrives in New York City. He's on the last he could possibly take back to Germany before you're forbidden from taking ships to Europe from the U.S. because of World War II. Wow.
Okay, Mark, I'm going to jump in, and we're almost going to leave this as a cliffhanger in that Bonhoeffer has made some theologically based decisions. He has sought the Lord. He has gone back to Scripture. He has consulted with brothers and sisters. As we often say on this podcast, he is doing theology in community, and it is affecting him. It's affecting how he lives. It's affecting what he does. And frankly, there is just too much still on the line for us to just say, Well, I think we have talked about everything, so y'all have a good day. I feel we need a part two. So you, our listeners, I guess this is a bit of a promise. There is something more coming. We don't have it on the books yet, but we will. Mark, thank you so very much for being our guest today, because I feel I'm about to walk away. My mind is firing. There is much in my heart. I can see by the smiles around all the screens that we're all very excited by some of the things that we are talking about. And I think the thing that I am most excited about is that it seems like such a simple thing that you quietly suggest it's a good idea to go back to scripture and listen to what it says there, as opposed to whatever is popular or whoever you like agreeing with your preconceived notions, that sometimes we should just slow down and actually believe what Jesus tells us and actually consult what we have in God's word and say, this might shape what I do and it might make things uncomfortable. But we are going to leave this on the shelf. We are going to come back to it. Mark, again, thank you for being with us today. And then thank you, our listeners, for joining us on this fun ride. If you want to continue to engage with Enphysiology, please go and check out past interviews and things that we have done on this podcast. If you want to see what it looks like to do theology in community, join us with the Ephesiology Masterclasses. Go to masterclasses.ephesiology.com to see what courses we can offer you. We have not yet been shut down by any governments, so it's still legal for you to learn with us on the interwebs and engage in what God is calling you to do. I'll just put this, you know, we'll be really excited for the next book that Mark will be releasing coming out on the Ephesiology Press on whatever he is plotting and planning. From Matt, from Mark, from Michael, and myself, thank you for doing theology in community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.